baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and you fill in the blank. Summer and Chevy go together like road trips and sunshine. Check out the full line of Chevy SUVs and trucks at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealers today. Chevy, drive Chicago.
Friday was National Beauticians Day. Did you know that? Did you go out and celebrate? It's a day dedicated to honoring the hard work of cosmetologists everywhere. A couple of weeks ago, I saw an article in the Tribune, and it was talking about a new law about loosening the licensure of cosmetologists. You know, it wasn't something that I gave a lot of thought to, but the more I looked into it, the more I realized that this is a topic that really needs to be addressed, and apparently the law has passed, and we're here with the person who was responsible in part for this whole very interesting issue, Noah Bazis. He's the legislative strategist with the Institute for Justice, which is part of the University of Chicago Law School. Thank you for coming in studio. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So people, you know, there's this talk about college being out of reach for a lot of people because of the cost, and some people just aren't inclined to go to college. And you would think that being a cosmetologist would be an easier avenue to get to what you want. But tell us how onerous the licensing rules are in Illinois if you want to be a beautician.
Yeah, so there are a lot of requirements that go into this. So just to start off the top, if we're talking about cosmetology, it is 1,500 clock hours, not credit hours. This is hours on the clock that you must be training within a licensed cosmetology school. And from our research for your Institute for Justice, we found that roughly equals out to about 350 working days lost to
wow.
the training. Yeah, so this is time that you could be earning a wage to support your family, and you're just unable to do it. In addition to that, there's supplemental education that needs to be done. There are all sorts of fees. You need an exam fee. There's an application fee for the license. If you don't pass the exam, then you have to pay the fee again. It's a lot of requirements that go into this. And, you know, just to put it into perspective, we find with occupational licensing generally that it's tough to find certain justifications in certain places. Perfect example are EMTs. The EMT basic, the first rating you need to get into the industry, is about 180 hours worth of training. You can do more
wow.
of that type of stuff. You could do more. You can, you know, exceed that and get more training and more specialties. But yeah, these represent significant barriers for people trying to get into the industry. And I'm from the IJ Clinic on Entrepreneurship. We work out of the Chicago Law School. We're trying to lower those barriers to entry, get more people into the workforce, make it easier for people to start a business.
And we also didn't talk about the cost of cosmetology school. I mean, what about, how much do you think on average do you have to pay actually to the school? Not
yeah.
to mention your time.
Yeah, the tuition is on average about $17,000. Some programs charge more, some programs charge a little bit less. But, you know, there's a student loans also play a significant role in this as well. About 75% of cosmetology students are taking out student loans, and it's usually around $7,000. But as you can imagine, there are issues with on-time graduation rates. Only about 29% of people graduate on time. So there are a lot of people in this industry that may have done part of cosmetology school or may have gotten all the way through and didn't pass the exam. They're still on the hook for all of that money. So yeah, it's $17,000. In the end, you can do well for yourself in cosmetology, make no mistake, but on average, we're looking at about $27,000 to $31,000 a year. And our research often finds that the expense sometimes isn't worth the cost that you receive on the back end. The ROI is really difficult to get.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, that we should make the ability to earn a living as easy as we possibly can.
Yes.
We want people in the workforce. We want people supporting their families. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how this impacts women maybe more than men, which, you know, is bad. But also we need to protect the safety of the public. So let's talk about the safety of the public. I mean, I said something just a few minutes ago about, don't we all know when we have a bad haircut or good haircut? Do we even need a license? I mean, obviously, maybe it's not obvious, but I mean, if you're going to be working with hair dye and you're working with things that could conceivably harm somebody or do something really, really, you know, harm your looks, you want someone to have some training. But What do you think? Is it necessary to have all these hours?
The thing that I want, if everybody forgets everything I say in this entire interview, the only thing that I want you to remember is that licensing is not the only way to regulate an occupation. It just so happens that it is the most onerous, the most burdensome on the folks applying to that occupation, the most expensive, the most administratively burdened. So we want to make sure that if you're going to propose a license, you have some really good reasons for doing so. There's all sorts of different ways that you can achieve the same kind of goals in terms of protecting health and safety. You can
like
do this.
What? Like,
so there are registrations, there are certifications. You can do insurance and bonding. It depends on the type of industry that you're in. But ultimately, the question that we want to answer is what problem are we trying to solve with a license? And can we use another regulatory or policy tool to solve that while we're lowering those barriers? To your point about people, you know, choosing their own hairstylist, there's an entire underground, gray market economy of people working out of their homes and posting on Instagram. People will say, don't go to this person, do go to this person. So there are people already doing this. So that's why we're so interested in finding these regulatory alternatives. We can have our cake and eat it too. We can lower barriers to entry while still protecting public health and safety 100%.
I have a nice texter from 708 who says, what a coincidence. I'm listening to your show and I'm cutting my own hair with clippers because my barber charges $32 to cut my hair. Hey, buddy, you know what? You got a bargain of the century. Noah Bazis, legislative strategist with the Institute for Justice, and we're talking about a new law that was passed that loosens the restrictions in the licensure of cosmetologists. Noah, tell us about how this law changes the current law.
Yeah, most definitely. So this law, for the first time in 40 years, we're opening up a pathway to achieve licensure in barbering, cosmetology, aesthetics, nail technicians, and hair braiding. For the first time, we're opening up a pathway through paid apprenticeships to achieve your licensure. So where this differentiates from current law is that that hasn't been an available pathway for folks. What this does is that it establishes a state-run program that allows people to work in licensed salons and shops under the supervision of a licensed professional. They are covering the same kind of curriculum that you would receive in cosmetology school. You do still have to pass the exam, but the big difference here is that you would be getting paid as you were going through. This is an earn while you learn pathway. And so this is an opportunity for folks to start at no less than the minimum wage of the state. And then as they gather up more skills and competencies, they're slowly working their way up and getting more wages until they hit their quote journeyman wage, the kind of wage that they would receive as a full licensed cosmetologist.
I'm always curious when you talk about the legislative process as to who is in favor of these laws and who is not. And my guess is that the beauty schools did not like this, because doesn't it take it kind of out of the beauty school and put it into the salon?
Well, I think that's really what this came down to, is we actually had a really positive working relationship with Illinois Association of Cosmetology Schools. Of course, they're a member-driven organization, and I think that people have kind of a misconception about a bill like this. They say, if someone can get paid to be an apprentice, why would anybody ever go to cosmetology school? It's the end of cosmetology school. The truth of the matter is that in 29 other states, we have state-run programs just like this. And our research demonstrates that in all 29 of those states, the majority of people still choose to go to cosmetology school. There's still an incentive to go because you'll be able to get to your journeyman wage a little bit faster. It's a little bit more of an accelerated program. So this bill, really, when we talked to the Illinois Cosmetology Association and we spoke to them about, hey, this is an additional pathway for people. It is not the end of cosmetology school. We talked about who it would help. This bill is for domestic violence survivors that got to get out of their situation and make money right now, today. This is for caregivers and people that are coming out of incarceration that need money in their pocket right now so that they don't go back to prison. So once we really explain to them, hey, this works in other states, there's still a strong incentive to go to cosmetology school, and look at the types of people that we're going to be able to help with this legislation, they said, you know what, that's something that we and our members can support. So they ultimately ended up supporting the bill, and we're excited to continue to work with them as we go forward with implementing it.
We've got a texter from 708. And speaking of Alcatraz, which was our prior guest, and barbers, last year a barber cut my hair who learned in prison. What, this is really true. That was a big place that people got trained for that very reason, that when they got out, they would have a readily available profession that would hopefully keep them out of the recidivist cell, right?
That's absolutely correct. And part of what this bill does, too, is that we reduce recidivism by allowing people, when they're close to the end of their incarceration, to, if they've done an IDOC program and Department of Corrections where they've learned how to barber, they can get their license right before they get out of incarceration. So that means license in hand, I can go get a job. And for folks that have a job coming out of incarceration, their recidivism rate drops by 62%. If I have that, that's my ticket going forward. And there was some misconception around some caucuses in the legislature saying, well, hang on a second. Is this going to overly benefit folks, you know, who are formerly incarcerated at the expense of other people? And absolutely not. But essentially, we did more education. We talked to members. And by the end of it, the folks that were unconvinced said, wow, this is a bill that's going to reduce recidivism, lower crime, create jobs and small businesses. This is absolutely something we can support.
And, you know, as a family law practitioner, that's the kind of law I practice these days. It's really interesting because I see a lot of women who maybe raised children and they were out of the workforce and now they have to get their license back. Sometimes they have to get some classes and all of that. But it's perfect for women who have children because they can work their schedule around, their job, which is wonderful. And I think this is really going to benefit not only people in prison, but largely women. Right.
Yeah, most definitely. Especially when you consider, you know, because it's such a woman dominated industry, but occupational licensing generally disadvantages women. So an occupational license, no matter what you do, is going to restrict the labor supply. And for folks that are taking care of families or are non-traditional students, it's going to really constrict the labor force for those occupations. We see about a 22% drop in the labor force for Black women, 27% for white women. So if you are a part of any marginalized community, we're talking about formerly incarcerated folks, any of those, you're going to have a more difficult time getting licensed. So this is especially important for women in this industry because occupational licensing can establish different barriers that, you know, get in the way of women moving forward in their profession. So again, let's make this additional pathway so that people can earn while they learn, support their families, get their license and go off and have a great career.
Does this new law impact the continuing classes and the coursework that they have to do? I remember this, maybe it was 6, 7, 8 years ago. My beautician told me that they had some classes that they needed to take, about domestic violence because the idea was that when you're near people and you see people as near as you get while you're cutting their hair, doing their hair, you can see bruises and you can see that people might be abused and that being trained in that field, you might be able to help people. While I think that's a wonderful thing and I think, you know, anyone who's, been a victim of domestic violence, anyone who can help you out is fabulous. But to put the burden on the hairdressers to do that seemed to me to be maybe the wrong solution to the right problem.
Sure. No, and I completely understand that. I think that the question that you need to be asking yourself is that this is great training. And I've volunteered in anti-domestic violence spaces for a long time. I think it's great. We have a different relationship with our hairstylists than we do with a server at a restaurant.
I've told
my stylist things I would be very careful not to tell other people. They are the keepers of secrets, in our society. So it makes sense that those folks would be uniquely positioned to do that. The question is that does this requirement for good training, does it have to be connected to a license? Is the license the only way to get this kind of training? Mm-hmm. Flight attendants are not licensed. They have to take some certifications. At the same time, they are federally mandated to take training that looks for signs of human trafficking. Right? So,
Yes. So
there are other ways that we can accomplish this. And, you know, remember, licensing is the most expensive, the highest level of regulation that we can get for occupations. There are other ways we can still get people this great training that they need, you know, without necessarily doing that. In the long scheme of things, at the very end, I understand where people are coming from. It's an hour of continuing education training for something that people find really valuable. My primary concern is those barriers to entry, that 1,500 hours, the 350 days lost, the $17,000 in tuition and fees. There's so much territory where we can reduce those types of barriers. Let's get people into the industry first and foremost.
That's right. And you're going to sink or swim. probably, right? I mean, the good people. I just had a texter who said 10 years ago she put her daughter through beauty school, and now all these years later she's making over $100,000. She's super successful, and you know, there's going to be people who rise to that level and are going to, you know, make a really good living, but the average, as you said before, is just not even close to that for most people.
Yes, you can do very well for yourself in this industry. You know, it's a great opportunity for lots of people. But yeah, we're public policy folks. We got to look at the averages and how it's affecting people in a broader sense.
Just a couple little minor detail questions. How did COVID move this along? Because it was kind of interesting when we were going through COVID, all the salons were closed for a period of time. And for those of you, not myself included, who might dye their hair, because I'm a natural blonde, as everyone knows that, you know, you were panicking because it's like, how am I going to get the service done? And, you know, a lot of the hairdressers went in their houses, or they came to your house and they weren't supposed to, but they did. So did the COVID episode sort of move this along in any way? And with the idea, too, that some people need those services in-house. You know, you don't want to spread illness. You don't want to, you know, older people may not want to come out to a hair salon, and they may want someone to come, and they would pay for them to come to their house.
Yeah, absolutely. We have not seen, in our research, the licensure around these types of occupations is basically the same as it was pre and post COVID. The biggest push that we got in recent memory in terms of occupational licensing form was under the Obama administration. 2008, 2009, the economy's hollowed out. We need to get people back to work as fast as possible. And through their analyses, they said, look, we're noticing some barriers here. Let's see where we can cut those barriers and reduce them to get people into the workforce fast. So that was kind of the biggest push. We at the Institute for Justice, we work with home-based business regulations all around the country. We won cases in Nashville. And for the Clinic on Entrepreneurship working out of Chicago, we have a lot of work to do, because in the city of Chicago, cutting hair in your home is flat-out banned. You cannot get a home-based business license for that. You can't run a business out of your garage. You can store papers in there, but you can't run a business out of it. Get out the tape measure, because you need to measure the exact square footage of how much area you can use for your business in your residence. So there are still a lot of barriers for home-based businesses, and we think that that's a way for how so many people get their start and how so many people build their way up to a brick and mortar. So we're going to continue to push and advocate for reductions in those areas as well.
So the law has passed in both houses, and is Governor Pritzker expected to sign it?
Yes, very much so. I believe from my inside sources have told me that he has already signed, put his John Hancock on it, so we are very, very excited
for it.
And
as I said to you off air, he's got a nice head of hair himself, so so that's a good thing. I really appreciate you coming on. This is a fascinating topic. I mean, it's an economic topic. It's a topic about opportunity, about gender equality. It's got all kinds of interesting aspects to it. Noah Bazis, he is a legislative strategist with the Institute for Justice, part of the University of Chicago Law School. Thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you.